your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to a new Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson. It is late Thursday night, so late. It is 11:57 p.m. Central Time as we are recording this podcast on Thursday, September 4th. The Chicago White Sox wrapped up their final series against the Minnesota Twins in triumphant fashion. Not only did they win the season series, but they sweep the Twins, or a mop, as Cespedes Barbecue calls it. The White Sox are now 53-88 as they have won five games in a row. According to Sarah Lanes of MLB.com, this is the first time the White Sox since 1986 have won five straight games when trailing in each one. In this episode, we'll recap the weirdness that was in Minnesota, and we'll preview this weekend series as the White Sox travel to Detroit, and unfortunately, we'll have to face Tarek Skubal this weekend. Joining me, hopefully with a cup of coffee nearby or some type of caffeine on hand, is Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And James and Jim, thank you so much for staying up to record this podcast with me. Jim, the White Sox had a great time in Minnesota this week. That rarely happens.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at the trade deadline and looking at the way the Twins dismantled their roster, like taking 10 players off their 26-man roster, while the White Sox did more or less the minimum, just trading players who are going to be free agents, basically expiring contracts. You know, they didn't trade Luis Robert. They didn't go out of their way to make any other, you know, deals that might shake things up. They liked the way things were going, it seemed, and just wanted to continue to see what they looked like with, you know, young players developing and like competent veterans around to provide some kind of framework for, you know, does this function as a team versus, you know, trying to hope that, like, you know, Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal just have like good individual performances around a wasteland, because I think they saw with a 121 loss season that it's really hard to take, apply individual victories towards a bigger picture when there's just nothing around it to contextualize, like, hey, does this actually help the team win? Or is it just, you know, good numbers in garbage time or just good numbers in a vacuum? And I think this series showed the effects of that. I think, you know, maybe one or two games, you know, the one where Michael A. Taylor won it with a line drive off the chalk, or this game, if like one of these games happened in the series, you just say, oh, these are just two bad teams just strangling each other in an alley and whoever breathes last wins. But I think like with this, with having four games like this, or four games where like the Twins let it get away, I do think you see the morale loss in Minnesota. You just see a lot of blank stares from Rocco Baldelli in the dugout. You see nobody in the stands, like every profanity, whether it's at the plate, to an umpire, in the dugout, like you can hear all of the favorite phrases that players use when they come back to a dugout, nicknames, rallying cries, etc. And it's just haunted there almost. It seems like it's just it's a very eerie a setting for baseball. And it's weird that the White Sox aren't the ones hosting it. That the White Sox are, you know, I'm so used to hearing the Ric Flair woos going back and forth from the first base side to third base side as they lose like 13-4 for the third consecutive game. And no, the White Sox were dishing it out. And I do think that probably, you know, the direction that each team took at the trade deadline had a lot to do with it. One, trying to build a team and trying to stack wins, even if they don't matter a great deal, versus another one that just, you know, probably, you know, ownership and front office cynicism taken to the highest degree.
Yeah, James, have you heard from the guys that have been reporting the Minnesota Twins, like Dan Hayes, like, have they been texting you at all? Like, what is it like covering the Minnesota Twins since the All-Star break?
I got a text from him saying, stop bothering me about this. I'm watching football. yeah, I mean, I think Dan wrote extensively about how like the team was demoralized by what they did at the trade deadline. Like, you had the situation like Griffin Jack's kind of seeing the direction they're going to and submitting a trade request kind of late, even though you wouldn't necessarily think Griffin Jack's, he had a very good setup reliever, was quite on like trade request level. He probably didn't think Aaron Civale was earlier in the season, but it's been an interesting year on that front. But yeah, I mean, it's familiar territory the way like Jim talked about, seeing guys who really, I don't know, seeing Noah Davis in multiple games this series, giving up a 450 home run and like his ERA went down for the season. They look like they won, like the White Sox at multiple points on Thursday kind of looked like they ran out of innings and they were just going to make Tyler Alexander make up the difference somehow, some way. But the Twins kind of really did, and being able to not even throw guys like, you can't even imagine this guy was really throwing that well in AAA before he got called up here, and the level to which like they've hollowed out like the top end depth of their major league bullpen. I mean, they lost four games where they blew a lead. It's as straightforward as it gets, and kind of puts the like as much as bullpens are put as like the last thing you should ever focus on and not really a good place to stabilize value. There is always like an end point where you kind of inflict a nihilism upon your team accidentally by, yes, this isn't a resource that you should overinvest in, but you can swing too far in this efficiency direction, where you just kind of, make games that don't end until everyone's will is broken. Because it's 5 hours after it was supposed to be done with, and even the podcasters of opposing teams are seeing their wills broken by what you're putting out there every night.
Yeah, it was not a well-pitched game on Thursday for the White Sox. I think if the White Sox had lost this game, Jim, a lot of conversation would be on Jonathan Cannon. And I know you just recently got a chance to watch Jonathan Cannon down in Nashville. But it was not good for Jonathan Cannon. Tyler Alexander did the best that he could to eat up as many innings as possible. But Jim, like the story of this Chicago White Sox 2025 is like a tale of two halves. There is the story of the pre-All-Star break White Sox, which a lot of times felt like a continuation of the 2024 season. The offense is not good. They're last in team OPS. Watching games sometimes is like pulling fingernails. Post-All-Star break, we have entered the fun bad era of the Chicago White Sox. And I know you mentioned it, like Michael A. Taylor, the unsung hero for Wednesday. I wasn't confident he was going to pull through. He did. The White Sox are down 3-1 in the ninth inning. They come back and they win 4-3. And tonight, despite blowing a 3-0 lead, down 7-4, come back and win that game 11-8. And suddenly, am I gaining confidence in this White Sox offense that when they are facing teams, let's say in the same tier, Detroit, different story. But they got games against Tampa Bay. They got games against Baltimore and Washington this month. In those series, if they're down late, I'm suddenly confident in this White Sox offense so they could pull through, Jim. And that's a much different feeling than I had at the beginning part of this season.
Yeah, this feels like one of those situations where you're setting yourself up for a little bit of too much optimism based on facing the Twins for four games. But it is a more cohesive offense, a more professional offense, an offense that can generate threats from more places. I think that's what gives you a different feeling, is just that if 6, 7, 8 are coming up in the order, it doesn't feel like you can fast forward two innings until like the good part comes back. Like there are chances for them to string together good at bats or take advantage of a pitcher who just doesn't have it that inning and string together some, some at bats that turn into a rally, that turn into a crooked number. So I think that's probably the biggest difference in terms of just where they are. Like in August, I just did the month in the box and they were around 20th in most categories, or like kind of hovering between median and maybe just, within a standard deviation of it on the below average side. But you saw some, you looked at the individual performances and they weren't terrible. Like you didn't have any like total stinker months from anybody. You know, they did cut Josh Rojas, but like the and they cycled through a bunch of bench players. But you know, the players you count on starting, you know, most games or like their 10 most played regulars, like they were fine. You know, we've seen them worse. Some had really good months, and you see like the natural talent or like the state of the talent now. I think they can get better, but you know, you still see some precociousness in there to where they can get shut down. You know, it rounded out to being slightly below average, but you know, perhaps at some point that becomes a floor for the team versus worst in the league or bottom three in the league. And you know, when you get a stretch like this against a team that just has nothing going for it arms wise, like yeah, they look like world beaters. But even we saw in their last series against the Twins, or sorry, against the Royals, like they put together decent efforts. Like you know, they made the Royals work for that series victory. The bullpen was more culpable in it. So you know, as they go to Detroit, as they go to other you know, more talented teams, more you know, teams that have more to play for, have more in the bullpen. I don't think they're complete bum slayers. I think they're going to be, you know, teams that probably get some plaudits from the opposing broadcaster saying, hey, for a last place team, they're not playing all that badly. Perhaps they've turned the corner. And I think that's more or less what we've seen since like May or so.
Yeah, the White Sox are 21-23 since the All-Star break. Now they have a positive run differential. So you could say, well, the White Sox should have a winning record post All-Star break just based on math. But this has been a pleasant surprise offensively for the White Sox. And I know we've talked a lot about Colson Montgomery. Montgomery hit his 17th home run. James alluded to it, the 454-foot shot. I think you texted in the group chat, Jim, that Twins announcers mentioned that that's like the farthest home run they've seen at Target Field. And that's kind of hard to believe since Jim Thome hit at that stadium, but it was an absolute bomb. But in Thursday's game, James, Will Venable, very creative, but it worked. Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro, top of the order for the White Sox, with Caro batting leadoff and Teal batting second. Could we see this more often through September? As Venable kind of showed his hand that not only am I going to play both of these guys in the lineup at the same time because I got three catchers, but I'm going to hit them at the top of the lineup.
Venable has showed his hand in the sense that there is no like one lineup setup that you'll really see emerge. I think if you're banking on like somebody claiming like the number two spot for years to come, like that's not really going to happen. Yeah. I think maybe Tauchman at the top of the lineup has like had the most security, but like, and Colson's generally been middle of the order since you know his powers kind of emerged, but I don't think they're either ones at the point where you're going to see them like in a set spot, like number one, number two all the time. I think you've seen Teal kind of steadily emerge in terms of like lefties he puts up there, where it's probably like going to be the first or second lefty after Tauchman. I think the most hint you got for Venable's like lineup structure is like the one time he like swapped Teal and like Montgomery in order, because it just kind of showed like the slotting of handiness is like how they move more than anything else. So like Teal and like Montgomery like swapped from 3 to 5, but that was like as far as he could advance, because otherwise Tauchman's occupying the spot and they weren't going to put lefties otherwise. So like Caro, I think, is going to have more mobility because like his, because he's a switch hitter, where he kind of grades out for like their threat matrix or whatever is going to change a lot based on like whether they're facing an opener or whether they're anticipating relievers and stuff like that. Whereas I think Teal is going to see him as like second or third lefty in the order. And then it, like Tauchman has the day off, which seems like he's been out of recent since I haven't been going to him even in pinch hitting opportunities, you know, which worked out with Michael A. Taylor on Wednesday. You see him then sneak into like a leadoff spot, but I think it's just something he fills in. He's a bit more OBP oriented than Montgomery, so you're probably not going to see Colson slip up to the one slot when Tauchman's out, but you could see Teal doing it. Ostensibly, like we just want to go back to like 2001 Moneyball. They both get on base, so putting him up top kind of makes on sense. Caro seemed like he maybe took the leadoff roll a little too literally in the first inning, but you know, that was something that kind of recalibrated over time. But I would expect Teal to kind of really kind of live in that 3 to 5 bucket, especially against right-handed pitching, and Caro to kind of move around based on how he's operating and who's pitching.
Yeah, the last 30 games for both of them, Kyle Teal's hitting 311, a 398 on base percentage, slugging 505. Caro's hitting 330 with a 357 on base percentage and slugging 472. And Jim, I know we've talked about it. We had Dan Zaborski in our previous episode. He says, still wait. Don't trade either of them yet because you need more data. You need more playing time for both of them to really pick one. If you do have a position surplus here and you need to trade one of them to patch up other holes for your lineup, I'm very much against the idea this offseason the White Sox trading either of them. I'd rather them getting creative and find a way that they could stash someone that you can count on to be a third catcher and still continue having Teal and Caro in the lineup. Because while they're undersized at first base, I don't think it's a good idea playing them in first base. If Teal plays in the outfield, it's left field, but you got Benintendi still with his contract. I still like the idea of having one catch and one DH and just have an emergency catcher on the bench going into 2026. How do you feel about the arrangement, especially since we're seeing both of them being really productive offensively? This is one of those good problems the White Sox finally have.
Yeah, Brooks Baldwin is the emergency catcher these days, right?
Well, it'd be like an extreme emergency
Yeah.
because.
Well, no, yeah, I'm not talking about like third cat, talking about like, Danny Mendick was in that role before, and I think Baldwin caught Mackenzie Gore, right, in high school. So.
I talked to him about it recently and he was like, yeah, I think I was emergency catcher.
Yeah.
It seems like actual communication with him was limited because it never got to that point, but he kind of deduced that he was since they know he's caught. I think I remember like asking him about like, and he brought up Gore, and I was like, oh, have you caught like someone throwing pretty hard? He's like, Gore was 4 to 6 back then, so yeah, I think I'm pretty good.
But I mean, I'm not worried, I guess, about the trade. Like, my attitude's more when it happens or if it happens, it happens. But I'm enjoying how weird this is. Like, I saw Caro and Teal 1-2 in lineup. I was like, hell yeah! Like, I don't know if it's a good idea, but just it had that sense of whimsy in the lineup that I'd wanted White Sox managers to have. Like I always go back to Joe Maddon being somebody just like, why are you batting somebody lead off? I don't know. I thought it'd be funny. And while like you might not bat an unorthodox leadoff guy there like 6 days in a row, like I think there's value in not stressing one position or one spot in the order so much. Like we saw that with Pedro Grifol and Tim Anderson and just Tony La Russa, Rick Renteria, Leury Garcia, just feel like you have to have a prototype in there or archetype in there who just has to take those at bats no matter what because anybody else is not going to be conditioned for it. And I can see in certain lineups that being the case, but when you have a very amorphous lineup right now and you have either platoon guys going in and out or guys being rested because of nagging injuries and you have so much switching back and forth, that does present the opportunity, everything being so fluid that, yeah, play at the lineup spots a little bit, get weird. Your last place team, you have a lot of bats who are doing good things. Why not put them up top in the top half of the order, get them more at bats, see what happens. And if it happens to take the shape of Caro batting leadoff, it might encourage him to do things he shouldn't do legs wise, but otherwise, like it's you're getting your better hitters more plate appearances than your worst hitters. And I think that's like a good principle to go off of when you're just trying to figure out who to give at bats, when and where. And if you don't get too committed to one person, then they can't be like, they can't really be asked about the pressure of a certain spot. It's just more, flirtations with, big roles or big ideas rather than, trying to find somebody who can do it. Kind of same thing with the closer situation right now, going between Jordan Leisure and Grant Taylor, even like a little bit of Mike Vassell by not like anointing a closer. You don't have the closer pressure or the blown save, pressure or the questions after a bad outing, you know, whether it's for the individual reliever or Venable. And I think you get the same thing to a much smaller degree when it comes to lineup spots.
On Saturday, September 6th, Sox Machine and Baseball Isn't Boring are hosting a live podcast at the Remova Theater. Doors open at 4 p.m. Central Time as I'll be hosting the live pregame show along with Courtney Finnecombe, chatting about this offensive surge from the White Sox, what was our favorite things about the 2025 season, and what the White Sox need to do this upcoming offseason to be more competitive in 2026. After the pregame show, we'll be hosting a live watch party of the White Sox versus Detroit Tigers game. Watch along with us while enjoying the wonderful new food menu from the Remova Grill. And don't forget about the new beer from the Remova Brewery, including Gene Honda's new brew. The show and watch party is a free event. You can RSVP either on SoxMachine.com or RemovaChicago.com. We can't wait to see everyone at the Remova Theater on Saturday, September 6th.
When you look at the war totals for the White Sox, especially on Fangraphs, if you are, again, a White Sox fan looking for hope and optimism, the fact that so many of the position player leaders are rookies, I do view that as a good sign and encouraging to see if they do take a step forward. It could help elevate this team going into 2026. The one thing that just kind of I thought of, Jim, Colson Montgomery having 17 home runs. He grabs the highlights because home runs are awesome. Chicks dig the lawn ball. Dice man, I need more information on that, James. That's your assignment next time.
No. Yes. Every other beat is like exhausting reporting capital, bothering him for this closely held secret. And I get that.
Okay. That's fine.
About his swing. And then he's like excited to talk about it.
Then your homework assignment.
You're asking me to cede my advantage. Like,
wasn't it a dice roll?
Dice roll. It's this dance move. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted James to find out. If you're not going to find out, if you're not going to find out,
CHSN is dedicating all the resources to it. And I think it's just making him clam up more or then, enjoy more that he's keeping a very silly thing a secret from a lot of people who are trying to find out.
Then I need you to figure out Will Robertson and Danger Zone as his walk up music. So there you go. You got two homework assignments.
Seems like a straightforward pun with Danger Will Robertson.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Okay, but anyways.
Curtis Meade's saga could also mean guy who is here for a week has not picked out his walk-up song yet and is getting something the PA staff thinks is clever rather than reflective of his choice.
Got it. Back to the question I was going to ask you, Jim. With Colson Montgomery, 17 home runs, grabbing the highlights, is he overshadowing just how productive Kyle Teal has been? Because at the end of the season, it could be Teal leading all White Sox position players in WAR.
I made a joke on Blue Sky about how, you know, Nick Kurtz is only going to win Rookie of the Year because all the rookies on the White Sox are splitting the vote. They're tearing the electorate apart. Like, who do I pick? Montgomery or Teal or Shane Smith or Edgar Carroll? Like, I can't choose. How do you pick your favorite one? I guess I'll go with Kurtz because you know, he has no opposition. But Montgomery, I think, is what gives him value is the fact that the shortstop play has actually been pretty good too, or surprisingly good. So I think, you know, there's the homers are one thing, and I think Sarah Lang's had a thing about how he's the only rookie with two 450-foot homers in a rookie year. And I mean, that's cool, but it wouldn't mean as much if he were like Daniel Palka out there, like hitting, you know, huge bombs and then being a huge liability in the field. And then you just have the question of, you know, where do we play this guy? Where do we stick him? You know, how do we hide him to get the most out of his power, but not have him face lefties or, you know, have him not, you know, commit costly errors. In this case, like Montgomery's hitting, you know, just tanks. And then in the one in the ninth inning made me laugh because a 2-0 sweeper, he swings over a sweeper that hits him in the leg. And then just like the classic rope-a-dope of, all right, you create a false sense of security, groove a fastball. And then it's what, 15 rows up in the upper deck. I did like the response of the one fan sitting up there of just like, touchdown, as the ball clanged back on the lower deck. Like, just, you know, what do you do in that case? There's also a very good nonchalant grab of Teal's homer that reached the concourse behind right field of a fan who's just like walking, just grabbed his mitt and just kept walking. It was a very, in this hellscape that Target Field is right now, you had some individual characters stand out for, they became the show, I think, to a sad degree. But I think that's what like gives Montgomery an extra dimension. I think Teal's good too. I think, his defense is still a work in progress when it comes to setting up and receiving. I think the White Sox pitchers aren't giving him a whole lot of help when it comes to slowing down the running game. There's been a lot of huge jumps recently. So I think like that part of his game is a work in progress, but yeah, the way his game has come around, Teal, like a pretty smooth transition. Like he had the OBP and then the power showing up with the OBP, like it hasn't been like an either or. Certainly worthy of, merit. I think, if anything, probably sharing the time with Caro is stealing more of Teal's thunder than Montgomery is, just because, no matter who plays, the White Sox have a fun young catcher to watch. And so, maybe you can take him for granted on the day he's not playing, still not missing him because, like, hey, Edgar Caro's around. I like watching him too.
Yeah, Baseball Reference has Montgomery already at 2.2 WAR this season. Caro second, according to Baseball Reference, at 1.8, and Kyle Teal at 1.6. It's been a while since what the White Sox at the catching position had two guys combine over 3 WAR. This is the best catching tandem they've got since, 2020 with Yasmani Grandal and James McCann, and that was a shortened 60-game season.
Yeah. I was thinking back to, Charles Johnson when the White Sox traded for him, and he turned into an all-world catcher. But,
It's also, it's obviously a chicken and the egg question of, are they pushing for more work or are they thriving because they're pretty fresh and they neither of them are really being asked to even consistently catch two out of every three games of every series. I think Teal tilts towards being their preferred option, if they really had to pick between one, but without having to ever run him down. He's set, because he hit 8 in AAA, he set a new career high for home runs in a season with 14. And it's 80 less plate appearances than he needed to get it, hitting mostly in AA last year. So, is it benefiting them in a way? It had to split. Can't really prove it until he trade one of them away or lose one of them to a devastating injury, which wouldn't necessarily feel like a clear sample, but something to consider, I guess.
A lot of positives from this series for the White Sox against the Minnesota Twins. But the White Sox win a season series against an American League Central foe. They were 2-5 against the Twins, and they reel off 6 straight wins against Minnesota. So some positive came out of this 2025 season for the White Sox, and hopefully some of that momentum can carry into 2026 for the Minnesota Twins. I've already seen the Twins' Twitter posting tank signs and GIFs on social media. Again, I wrote about this on Sox Machine. The MLB draft lottery has been very chaotic. So even if they are in the bottom 5, maybe that does help out with the Minnesota Twins, but aiming for the number 1 or the worst record in Major League Baseball, right now the White Sox still have the best odds of having the number 1 pick. We have yet to see a team with the best odds of having the number 1 pick actually get the number 1 pick. So tank 2, whatever, Minnesota, it's all up to the lottery. As I'm sure all of us will be playing Friday night as a Powerball is inching closer to gaining some enough cash to buy some significant shares of the Chicago White Sox, if you know Justin Ishbia. But for the White Sox, after winning this series against the Minnesota Twins, they now make their way to Detroit. And this is a much different story for the White Sox, as the Twins are reeling, posting the worst record since the trade deadline. Detroit still gaining steam. They're 81-60 on the season. First place in the American League Central by a very comfortable margin. They have a 9.5 game lead over Kansas City. If the season were to end today, Detroit would have the second seed in the American League postseason. They won their last game, but Detroit struggling a little bit. They're 3-7 their last 10. They have been awesome at home. They are 45-27 at Comerica in 2025. And against the White Sox, they are 7-3. They have scored 48 runs against the White Sox. They've only allowed 35 to the White Sox. Your pitching problems for this series, the White Sox will be landing very early Friday morning. So let's see on how they recover from a very late night in Minneapolis. But it'll be Shane Smith for the White Sox against Jack Flaherty. Saturday night, 5:10 p.m. Central Time. A reminder, the watch party at Rimova Theater. Doors open at 4 p.m. Central Time. The pregame show starts at 4:30 p.m. as Courtney Finnecom from Baseball Isn't Boring will join me as we'll preview as far as that Saturday night game and watch it along with you guys. It's Martin Perez for the White Sox, who's been very good against Tarik Skubal. And then on Sunday, yes, it is NFL Week 1 kickoff. Davis Martin will take the ball, the dart, against Charlie Morton. That first pitch is at 12:40 p.m. Central Time. From a White Sox perspective, James, Shane Smith, in his last seven starts, 36 2/3 innings. He has a 2.95 ERA with 36 strikeouts to just 13 walks. He's only allowed 21 hits. He's got a whip of 0.93. The Tigers are a very good team. My thought is, can Shane Smith stay hot? When teams have this late arrival or very early arrival, from your experience, does that impact starting pitchers? Because at least they got a chance to sit on the bench. And I know it's a late flight, but mentally, they're not going to work until the next day.
Anecdotally, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I don't think there's like a longitudinal study about like what happens. Paul Byrd in game one of the ALCS was pretty sharp, even though the Angels got in late, for bringing up random times, it doesn't matter. So he can't be like, when they're at home and the starting pitcher for like a day game, the next day gets like go home early. I don't know if that really works when you have to go to the next city, but otherwise, I don't know. I can't imagine any baseball player publicly admitting, especially in like September, of non-playoff team of all places, being like, oh, the travel got to me. But they did give him an extra day of rest. And, busting his routine is something he hasn't dealt with great before, but I feel like he's adapted to it a bit better. And now he's just challenging people with fastballs in the zone, so he doesn't need to be perfectly calibrated for this. He's no longer counting on having like perfect secondary command or worrying about all that. His biography of the season is going to be how I learned to stop worrying and just throw 98 down the pipe. So that's been his mode of success of recent. The Tigers are ready for that. Maybe they'll have a decent night, but mostly Smith is trying not to walk himself out of any games anymore.
All right, well, it's a good strategy. We'll see how he does on Friday against Jack Flaherty. So something to watch for White Sox fans is how well Shane Smith is commanding his fastball. And hopefully he does stay hot, because this is encouraging. And I know we talked a lot about the offense, Jim, but the White Sox do need some frontline starters, because the White Sox didn't get great news. James, I think you retweeted it. The White Sox announced that Noah Schultz is back on the injured list because of knee discomfort.
Yeah, recurrence of the knee, essentially.
Okay.
They said it's precautionary, for what it's worth.
Sure. The White Sox not getting exactly a promising seasons out of Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith. We'll push that into 2026 and see what they can maybe offer to the White Sox if either of those guys are ready to join the major league.
Might affect what they can offer to the Glendale Desert Dogs more immediately than that.
Oh yeah, I forgot they were both supposed to go to the Arizona Fall League. Okay, well, that's something to watch. But for Shane Smith, for him to bounce back, because we did have that concern around the All-Star break that he was slowing down, wasn't posting good results. But in his last seven starts, it feels like we're watching the Shane Smith at the beginning part of the season that did deserve to be the White Sox All-Star representative.
Yeah, and it was a case where, the changeup was a devastating pitch and it just wasn't competitive. It wasn't, he's trying, like James said, trying to throw perfect ones and not setting it up. And, Yeah, talking to Jonathan Cannon and going through what the White Sox had prescribed for him, it seemed like he needs to be very precise with what he has, or more precise than he has been when it comes to really establishing the inside corner so he can set up that changeup away. It seems like Smith, with extra ticks and extra hop on his fastball, like having a four-seamer that Cannon doesn't have, it really seems a lot simpler for him. Just try to get to two strikes no matter what. Like, just try to, don't worry about, because they can't really seem to lift you or punish you that much. If you do miss a little bit too much in the zone, you can just go right at them. If they make you bleed, then maybe start worrying. But until they hit you into trouble, don't worry about it. And it seems a lot simpler. And I think pitchers who have that kind of changeup, we kind of see the difference too with like Davis Martin versus Sean Burke. Pitchers who can just get a changeup, get weak contact early in accounts to shake off or negate a plate appearance that went seven or eight pitches the batter before, is really something that can stabilize a pitcher over an outing. And, given everything he's been through this year in terms of Rule 5 pick, battling for a roster spot, somehow making the rotation, then making the All-Star team, setting a new high in innings, just everything kind of coming at him fast, I think he's done a pretty good job handling it. And even, though he did have a rough patch, like his status as a member of the White Sox pitching staff has never been in doubt. Like, they never had to worry about like the Rule 5 status or anything like that. Same thing with Mike Vassell. It's just amazing how stable they've been for as little as they'd proven before this point. The fact that Smith has the ability to make it simple is a difference maker to this rotation, especially since the guys, like Schultz and Smith that we talked about, the guys who were supposed to make it simple are currently not in the minors.
I should note that Smith is like, he's upped his fastball usage, but the bulk of it is using a sinker more. So that's how he feels like he's using, like showing different things, even while kind of still just challenging people in the zone more. And speaking of the guy in April, he is, after his career high in innings, he averaged 96 on his fastball in August, which is a tick higher than he was throwing in April. So he's gotten stronger as the year has gone on.
No, that's a great sign. Again, on the offensive side, we're starting to see answers and get excited for next season. On the pitching side, we talked about it many times. It feels like the pitching staff is running out of gas. It's a good thing that the White Sox offense is picking up their production and helping gain some wins. But Shane Smith has been really strong in his last seven starts, and he was really strong against the New York Yankees. So we'll see what he does against the Detroit Tigers lineup. I feel like Friday and Saturday could be really low scoring games. Unfortunately, the White Sox cannot duck Tarik Skubal in 2025. Last year in two starts against the White Sox, Skubal did not walk a batter against the White Sox, only allowed three earned runs over 11 innings with 14 strikeouts to 11 hits. So not a lot of success for the White Sox last year against Tarik Skubal. We'll see on how it goes on Saturday. That's probably a game, Jim, that Colson Montgomery gets benched, right?
If they could, like, if there's a reason to, but I am looking forward to.
Do you want Montgomery to face Skubal?
I mean, I'm looking forward to the series in terms of just like, after watching them beat up bad pitching, like, let's see how they face against good pitching, like kind of like the Royal series. Like, I don't necessarily advise White Sox fans to like enjoy watching the White Sox play the Royals because it doesn't end well, but it is instructive in terms of like facing good pitchers, facing a good bullpen, facing a team that is going to be deploying those pitchers in a way to win the game versus, having a Minnesota team that's just trying to find arms to get through the season and not having them and, losing all context for what's actually worthy of the major leagues. Like, it's, it's nice to have the two experiences in 1 week of pad your numbers and then actually test yourself.
For what it's worth, the last time Montgomery sat versus a lefty, Venable not only insisted that it was about workload first rather than the matchup, but actually said he would view Montgomery as rested. Putting him in against a tough lefty is a good developmental opportunity for him. So, like, there's always that push-pull between, like, it's just platooning for smart managing, or like do you give a young player an actual like opportunity to get better against same-handed pitching? And so I think Montgomery is of that stage where they would probably lean toward exposing him, you know, especially with Vargas out and you're a little bit down on your primary infield options. I wouldn't necessarily expect him to sit versus Scooble unless like he had already, there was like, hey, he's played a week in a row and we were planning on giving him another night off. And so if we did, we thought we'd give somebody who has a fighting chance against a left-hander the start. Not that you can really pull anyone off the White Sox bench and be like, he lines up great for Scooble. This is going to be awesome. Though Lenine, I feel like, is somebody who is either going to go 0 for 3 against him with three strikeouts, or is going to go 1 for 3 against him with two ugly strikeouts and one extremely long home run. So it seems
Yeah.
like the sort of chaos he'd engineer.
I could see the infield where this would be a good opportunity to get Brian Ramos in the game. Like, have Ramos play third, Beak go over to first, my draw at that shortstop, Sosa at second. I could see that type of infield for Saturday for the White Sox. Try to get as many right-handed bats early in the game. And then when Scooble leaves, then maybe bring in Montgomery if you're trying to win it. But we're still trying to figure out what the playing time is for Brian Ramos. Not getting a whole lot of it. Curtis Meade has been pretty productive offensively for the White Sox. So we'll see on how Will Venable shakes up the lineup as the White Sox finally face Tarik Skubal. Three veteran pitchers this White Sox offense is going to be facing. So this is a good litmus test after the series against the Minnesota Twins. And hopefully it's not a letdown, but it is a much tougher series for the Chicago White Sox. And we'll be recapping that series on Sunday night's podcast. And hopefully it is not a very late night for us on Sunday night. And they get that game in at the first pitch at 12:40 p.m. Central Time. But thank you guys so much for listening to this episode on Friday, September 5th. And hopefully you enjoy the weekend and the games between the White Sox and Tigers. And see many of you at the Remova Theater on Saturday night. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. You can subscribe to the Sox Machine Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at Sox Machine underscore Josh. We are on Instagram as we're trying to get more followers there and put up more pictures and graphics. So if you're on the gram, follow us over there. We're also on Blue Sky at SoxMachine.com. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. That gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. We also have a couple spots open at our Veterans Committee. So if you want direct access to Jim and James in the group chat, get a knowing of behind the scenes of how things work at SoxMachine.com. We'll be meeting with our VCs pretty soon about our plans for the 2026 season. You can inquire again at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.